And I, you know, Jesse just gave a fantastic talk that, by the way, I won't be able to match, even with my colorful slides. And he told me, essentially, that I should have been talking about double beta decay and not what I'm, what the topic is. Too late at this point. Those are the slides I have. And anyway, double beta decay, unfortunately, is not very much tabletop anymore. And so this is actually really the tabletop. Okay, so the plan, I usually don't have a plan, but this is a relatively long talk, so I figure I should have a plan. I'm going to be introducing why we want to measure gravity or find anomalies for gravity at short distance. Talk a little bit about the physics of optically levitated little objects, and then give you some mix of technical developments, because this is a new technique, and other results in particle physics which are not quite related to gravity. Then go on and show you the first gravity measurement, the first published gravity measurement using this technique, and tell you why we're going to be able to very soon get rid of all backgrounds and do the best measurement ever. And you know, the goal is to convince you both that we have a new technique for measuring gravity at short distance, but also that in the process we have you know, the community, not just us, but I mean the community has developed tools that will be useful for many other things. Okay, so now I'm going to go really fast here because at perimeter I'm not going to be, I am not the person talking about the theory. But clearly from the point of view of a lowly experimentalist, gravity is the most evident of the fundamental forces. In fact, a friend of mine, when I used to be at CERN and my son was, you know, I don't know, 2 years old and would fall down all the time, he kept saying, my friend used to say that my son was testing gravity, was doing gravity experiments, which is kind of true. It is also the weakest of the forces, and it is the least known of the interactions in nature. And you know, essentially, this, from my point of view, this this table comparing gravity with our interactions essentially explain, you know, it already gives you lots of insights. And the only other thing maybe to add is that there's no such thing as anti-gravity. And this has lots of really important implications about the phenomenology of those things. All right, so experimentally, the first, you know, the obvious thing is measuring the strength of gravity. This is something that Cavendish did. In fact, the instrument was built by certain Mr. Mitchell, who actually we have forgotten about. And you know, this is like, at this point, like more than 200 years ago. And measuring G, the gravitational coupling, is something that has been done many times with, you know, some substantial dispersion of results and, you know, not reaching particularly good quality, you know, still with uncertainties that are quite substantial compared to the other coupling constants that are here. So there are disagreements between those various measurements. However, since I don't know how to predict big G, I find it somewhat less compelling to actually try to measure it. I mean, there is a community measuring big G, but since there's no real prediction coming from theory, you know, it's unlikely I find it actually to discover something new. Whereas on the other hand, trying to, yes.
So when they measure little g, what is the dimensionless number they measure? Because you cannot measure a dimensionful quantity. The big G, the G Newton. So what do they compare it to?
They compare it to, no, I mean to a spring, which is to the elastic, I mean to the spring constant of a torsion fiber. I haven't really thought about this, Mina. We should talk maybe offline, because or maybe at the end. I don't, because okay. I'm just, this is really a side remark, so I don't want to get bogged down in this. Okay, so and the thing is that it's generally, at least in my opinion, is more interesting to actually check whether the inverse square law is.
Sorry, one other quick question about this past slide. Is it really true that in 200 years we have gone just 1.5 orders of magnitude in big G? Like, is that the statement that I'm supposed to understand?
This is
here?
11 pp. No, I mean, okay, so this is essentially 10 par per thousand, and this is 11 par per million. So if anything, it's like three orders of magnitude, right?
Okay.
Okay, but these are the real numbers, right? So, I mean, you know, maybe off by 20%, but I mean, that's, you know, that's what it is, okay? It's three orders of magnitude, and yeah, the progress is very slow, and it, you know, and the measurements don't particularly agree with each other. Okay, but let me move on, sorry. So the in my opinion, more interestingly, one should really check whether the inverse square law applies to short, you know, to different scales and different distances. And I think we heard this also from Peter Graham yesterday or the day before. Generally here, I just want to give you the parameterization. So if I only have traditional Newtonian gravity, that the number one applies here, so the potential is written this way. Otherwise, there is a correction that has a distance scale, lambda, that is also some sort of a cutoff, and then the strength that is alpha. So essentially, one way of parameterizing these things, which is not the most general thing, but is generally accepted as being a useful way, is actually using, you know, is actually this thing. And then what you're measuring is the two free parameters, alpha and lambda. All right, so that's where we are. And this was shown again by Peter Graham a couple of days ago, so it's nothing sort of new. As function of lambda, that is the distance, you see how far, how deep down we have excluded certain strengths of this non-Newtonian component. And you can see that the best measurement is done at the distance of the orbit of the moon. By the way, here I have meters on this scale and astronomical units here, because this you know, this really spans a very broad set of distances. Astronomy actually really helps for those measurements. By the way, remember at the beginning I said that there's no anti-gravity. That's, for instance, important here because, you know, you wouldn't do electromagnetism, you know, measurements in ENM using the moon because there is anti-electricity, and so the moon essentially is neutral. And actually free space, you know, in the solar system is essentially a conductor, which is kind of a counterintuitive sort of thing because there are, as soon as you have, you know, strong forces from ENM, you start pulling electrons from one side and the other, and everything gets neutralized. But you cannot neutralize the moon. You cannot neutralize the mass of the moon, and so large objects are actually very good at, you know, for doing gravity measurements. And so what we're interested in. Okay, so and this is actually gives you a little bit, you know, the domain of those measurements. And if you go down to so actually this region is particularly annoying. You can see that we know very little about this region, and that's because anomalies in the inverse square law are degenerate with finding oil or water or, you know, uranium ore or something. So the Earth is not homogeneous at the level of, you know, 100 meters to a few kilometers, and so you just can't do very good measurements there. But we are really interested in the very short distance scale. That is down here, and in fact below this region. And that is for a number of, first of all, because that's where tabletop lives. If this was on a planetary scale, we wouldn't be, it's an anthropic sort of consideration, right? I mean, you know, you can do measurements at planetary scale, but then Mina would not invite you to give the seminar, and so you wouldn't know about it. So we are really interested in this kind of short distance scale, but also because people who know theoretical physics tell us that that's where we should be looking. And I'll leave it there. I mean, some of the people who actually, the artists who produce this kind of things are in the room, Savas, right? You sketched that for the first time. But I'll leave it here because people here know much more about this. Than I do. But I'm going to now, on the other hand, go and see what are the experimental challenges for doing this. And so you see, first of all, that in many cases, you measure a force. And this force is, you know, goes with some constant, which is just a number. And then the two masses, and then 1/r². The masses are essentially the densities times the volumes. The density, you know, is the density of iron or lead or something. You know, if I could use a neutron star, nuclear matter, I would be doing better, but I cannot. And so I'm stuck with, you know, density of, say, you know, few grams per cubic centimeter. And so, you know, and the volumes are essentially the distance cube, each of them. And so in the end, if you're, you know, the force scales in a way that is not very, you know, goes down with the distance to the fourth power. And so you lose very, very quickly when you go to the small distance. Well, okay, maybe you can actually measure accelerations. And if you measure accelerations and you use the equivalence principle, then you only your force only goes down with linearly with distance, but still it goes down with distance. And so as you go to smaller and smaller distances, the force you have to measure becomes smaller and smaller. When you're below 100 microns, and this is just an order of magnitude, but when you are down in the micron regime, nothing is really neutral. And in fact, we'll see that what we're doing, you know, the things we use are really very neutral, but you still get essentially dipole moments and multiple moments, and those interact with gradients of electric field, and so you actually get spurious forces and you get background forces. So this is in some sense the crux of this thing when you go to short distance, maybe more so than measuring small forces. And then finally, this is not really a limitation, but you know, it's something that I want to add because actually, because of the fact that many of those backgrounds are not very well understood, experiments oftentimes don't have really discovery potential. In other words, you know, you what you do is that you start doing the measurement, and then you see something which you say, well, this must be the background, and so then you put the limit there. Which means you can never do a discovery. You can always, you know, you can exclude something, but you cannot make a positive discovery. And so we're spending quite a bit of time trying to understand backgrounds, ideally like you would actually do in, say, a neutrino experiment, which is my other sort of personality, where it is true that there are radioactive backgrounds to our measurements, but we know them so well and we can predict them so well that you can, at that point, you can subtract them. And if you see an effect beyond those backgrounds, you know pretty well that that's a signal and it's not the background, okay? So in this field, we're far from that kind of sophistication, and I think we need to make lots of progress. So traditionally, those kind of things, those measurements are done by essentially comparing the gravitational interaction or this new force with the elastic force from a spring. The most traditional one is a torsion fiber. The spring is a torsion fiber, and you know the best measurements, you know, by far, the most progress has been done using torsion balances, more and more sophisticated sort of version or varieties, and in particular the people, you know, colleagues up in US of Washington have been the masters of all this. You can see this thing as the size essentially of a soda can. And so that means that if you want to, and you are measuring the coupling of some sort of segmented disk, that is this thing that looks shiny here, with another disk that is also segmented and is spinning or is rotating under it, and then there is a membrane to actually shield electrostatic interactions. But that means that you have something which has a size of centimeters, and you need to actually approach to, you know, tens of microns, something else. Everything has to be planar, very well, you know, in a very, you know, good way. And so that's sort of a challenge to actually use something that is microscopic to do those microscopic measurements. In recent times, there's been also measurements done with micro cantilevers, and this started actually with Aaron Kapitulnik's group at Stanford, I think. But there's been more done this way. And, you know, this is a similar thing. You just use a spring from a silicon cantilever, and then you have some sort of modulated mass that is actually exciting the coupling between, you know, so you study the coupling between a mass that you've glued essentially to your cantilever and some sort of modulated mass underneath. So, you know, it's to some extent, they're actually, those two things are very similar because they always use a mechanical spring. And so now I'm zooming in on this region at very short distance. You see that this is now a millimeter, and it goes down to a tenth of a micron. And this is going up, as Peter explained us, actually, how this thing is expected to scale. And in fact, it does scale very fast. There's many orders of magnitude on the vertical axis. And those are the various measurements done by various groups, some using those torsion balances and others using micro cantilevers. As you go to shorter and shorter distances, you have this issue of backgrounds from essentially electrostatic interactions. And in fact, I would claim that some of those measurements really have no discovery potential. Ideally, as we had a talk earlier today about neutrons, and neutrons have a charge radius which is much, much smaller than that of atomic matter, and so they are particularly appropriate for this, except I usually joke, actually Peter Feerlinger reminded me this, that I joke that neutrons don't exist. That is to say, neutrons, if you want to select neutrons in some region of phase space, momenta or something, that you get so few that it's very, very hard to do measurements. I mean, they do exist, but they're not very common. But there are, nevertheless, there are measurements at very short distance done with neutrons. There's no bound states between, say, two neutrons or something, or at least they are, but they are inside nuclei, so you can't really access those things. So those are scattering experiments, and so they're really not very sensitive. And so you do get measurements here, but they are, you can see that now this is 10 to the 12, and this is alpha is like 10 to the 25, right? So at this point, you're very, very insensitive. I mean, you're doing a measurement, but maybe you don't expect to actually really see something there. All right. So how do you measure small forces? Well, first of all, our mascot, the seal, has a mass of about 100 kilograms. And so, when you put it on a scale, it's like on the Earth, it's about 1 kilonewton. If you go down to one of those things that they tell you is in your pillow and you breathe it all the time, it's actually, it's about 10 to the minus 7 newton of weight. E. coli is 10 to the minus 14 newtons, and then our favorite virus is 10 to the minus 19, and a carbon atom is down here. And this is just to give you an idea of scales, right? So conventional atomic force microscopy goes down to 10 to the minus 12 newtons, and fancy cryogenic AFM goes down to order 10 to the minus 16 newton per square root of hertz. That's the noise floor that you actually have with those things. Okay, so that gives you an idea of what kind of forces you can measure. And so, for instance, you cannot weight COVID-19, a single virus, using something like this. You can do, you can probably accelerate it in some sort of mass spectrometer or something of that sort, but you cannot really measure the mass or the weight with some sort of a spring. So the what we want to introduce, or what along with many other people we have now introduced, is a technique that was invented many, many years ago, and in fact, for which Ashkin got the Nobel Prize a few years back, and that is optical levitation of various objects, in particular dielectric objects. And so the idea is that now you have a beam of light that is propagating up, and this is actually not like all of those traps work, but this is, turns out this is the way our trap works. And so we just really copied from essentially Art Askin. And so the radiation pressure pushes up and suspend the object that is like a quartz microsphere against gravity. And then there is all sorts of other things you have to do around this thing, but this is just the very first paper of this. There is even a picture of the microsphere suspended in this kind of laser beam. In the last 50 years, the technique has matured a great deal, and has been used actually for the most part not in air or in vacuum. The previous thing was done in air, but in water, in some sort of water suspension, because this is very useful for biological or biophysical applications. So there's been lots of work in biophysics using those optical tweezers, the way technique is called. The idea is that your laser beam is really focused, And so the microsphere is suspended against Earth gravity, which, by the way, Earth gravity is a nuisance here. It's nothing to do with any of the gravity things we care about. And so you undo Earth gravity by pushing against it with radiation pressure, and then the focusing and how you can think of the microsphere as a little lens, and then you can actually look at as you move it away from the axis of the laser beam, you can actually see what kind of recoil force you get, and you can convince yourself that this is like an attractive potential. In other words, the microsphere wants to be on the axis of the beam, and it's kind of a stable position there. There is a number of interesting features about this, which are listed here, and I don't actually read them all. But if you want, one important thing is that there are two main differences from the previous technique, if you want to measure gravity or new forces. So what you're doing is that you're comparing the force against the spring constant now of a light beam of this optical trap, which is, so there's no mechanical spring. But then for the same reason now, your sensor, that is the microsphere, is really floating in free space. There's no electrical connection, for instance, with the rest of your system. And so, for instance, you can decide what its charge state is and just keep it that way, or change its charge state. And we'll see a number of tricks that have to do with the with charge state of this. And so then the measurement is kind of obvious at this point, at least in principle. You bring some attractor in, which is, again, something that is modulated in density, like a piano keyboard where every other key is gold or silicon, let's say, or something. And then you just essentially raster scan it in front of the microsphere, and then you look at the motion of the microsphere, or essentially by the motion of the microsphere, you measure the force that is the microsphere is subject to. The apparatus looks like a relatively simple AMO system. This has to be done in vacuum, so the microsphere is sitting in the middle of this kind of gold-plated device here. The laser beam comes vertically this way, and then there is optics on the input and the output to actually provide the light and essentially measure the light that comes out, and from that figure out what the microsphere is doing. The microsphere, again, because of all these horrible electrostatic problems, there is this gold-plated device here, which I describe as device. It's essentially a way of shielding the microsphere from external fields, but more than that, to essentially also provide some fields that are used for various sort of tricks that one wants to play with on the microsphere. Okay, so the first thing is that once you you put the microsphere on the beam, you load your trap, as you say. Of course, the microsphere is falling down from some sort of piece of glass with lots of microspheres on it and so on. And it's unclear what kind of charge state this thing will have. The microsphere, by the way, okay, so yeah, the microspheres we're talking about here have few micron diameter silica spheres. And by now, there's many people doing this is a technique that is has become very common, and there's lots of science being done with this, not just in biology. And in fact, some of the leaders of this thing are here. Marcus is actually typically working with somewhat smaller microspheres, which have different technical sort of issues or properties and so on. Dave Moore, I don't know where Dave is with all this group, is actually working on similar things. Again, with somewhat large, in this case, with microspheres similar to our size. But for our microspheres, there is this few micron thing that is actually put in the optical trap. And so now you can actually start using the kind of equipment you have around there. So for instance, you can take two of those, little sort of plates, gold-plated plates that are around the microsphere, apply an AC voltage between them, and see the microsphere move if there is a charge on the microsphere. And you can actually keep doing this, and then you neutralize the microsphere, which you do by essentially doing what I just said the space is essentially conductive. So you just flash a little bit of a UV light in there, and electrons get mobilized, get freed up from whatever surface has too many electrons, and they end up on the other surface. And so by doing this, you can learn how to change the microsphere charge, positive or negative. And eventually you get down to the point where you can see the quantization of charge very clearly. So this is two charges, one charge. Now you're neutral. And you know you're neutral because now you boost your electric field amplitude by a large amount. And so you see that there is essentially noise here. And this is this Gaussian thing is nicely centered around zero, which means your thing is really neutral. And then if you keep doing the flashing of the UV light, now you actually reverse the charge by one unit. And so this is actually very easy to calibrate. The other day I was talking to some of you how you calibrate the experiment. This is actually easy because this is definitely one elementary charge. And so you know what force this corresponds to because it's EQ. And so this is all very well, clearly well understood. All right, so there are specific issues, though, when you want to bring something very close to this microsphere. Imagine now you have this little thing that is floating in some laser sort of field, and you want to bring a few micron distance this piano keyboard, as I described it, okay? So you can see it sort of here. This is the microsphere, and about 5 microns away, there is this end of this sort of beam that is the modulated thing that actually produces the modulated interaction. Okay, so some of the things you can imagine this will do is that first of all will perturb the optical field. After all, there is some sort of laser mode that is propagating in there. This thing, has tails. There's diffraction. There's all sorts of things. And so when you bring this thing, this cantilever so close, you're going to somehow perturb the optical mode of the trapping beam. And I already mentioned that there are forces emerging from gradients, and then eventually there's Casimir forces. Those in principle are calculable, but that gets really tricky because then you have to know the distance really well, and you have to know the properties, the properties of the various materials really well. Mina, yes.
So how big are they at those distances? The residual, so at the. Because now you have no shielding, essentially, between.
I'll get to the shielding. Okay. This is actually a cartoon. I'll make the cartoon a little bit more meaningful in a minute. Okay. So, but you're right. Eventually there's. But at the distances of say 5 microns, we're still quite far from Casimir forces being the dominant problem. So, but then still, it's interesting to see. Okay. So, I said there are all these issues when you bring something close. Are those issues sort of deadly? No, you can actually build a force microscope, essentially, that is something that measures a force vector field in over a three-dimensional space, and it measures the real vector. So that's actually what's shown here, or in fact, maybe let me just show you. Let me go backwards a little bit. So that's actually maybe the way to actually show this first. So in this case, I deliberately put some charge on the microsphere. And then I bias the cantilever, which is again gold-coated or something. And so now you see that I'm mapping the electric field at different positions. What I do is that I move the microsphere position respect to the cantilever, which actually is done by moving the cantilever and leaving the microsphere where it is, but that's kind of irrelevant. And you're really mapping the three-dimensional field. And here the two colors, red and black, are an FEA calculation of what it should be and the measurement. So you see that this works really quite well. And now if I go back, now if I don't have a charge, at least not deliberately, you're measuring essentially the noise of the measurement. And never mind, this is actually complicated because I really should show you a three-dimensional thing, which is hard to do on a slide. But this is really measuring the three components of the force on a three-dimensional array of points. And the noise is of the order of, you can see 1 degree of freedom here works somewhat less well than the others. This is actually somewhat old data. But you can actually, you have noise of the order of few attonewtons. On this system, okay? And those measurements, this is again an old paper, so the closest distance was like 15 microns, but actually you can do better than that. All right, so this is essentially like atomic force microscopy, but it's actually at that kind of, at attonewton level, this is cryogenic AFM, so it's pretty fancy AFM. You cannot go as close as AFM, or at least that's not done here. But on the other hand, you are fully three-dimensional, and you can explore the volume in 3D. So it's sort of a complementary technique to AFM. Okay, so the other thing you have to do is that, okay, so how large are those microspheres? I told you how large they are mechanically. in terms of linear size, but what's the mass of those things? And so we have developed the technique to actually measure the mass. And again, you can do this because you can change the charge of those things in an exquisite way. So you add one charge, and now you see, as you apply an electric field on the vertical dimension or direction now, you see how much you have to decrease the radiation pressure to actually balance the electrostatic force. And you know, I can never turn off the beam completely because then the thing, because then I cannot measure where the thing is. I need the light to also do the measurement, not just to support it. But I can change it a little bit, and so you can see that the optical power, how it changes as I change the electrostatic force they apply. And now I can extrapolate all the way to zero optical field. So this would be essentially the electrostatic force I would need to support the microsphere. And although this looks like a long lever arm to extrapolate, you actually get a pretty good distribution of forces and therefore of microsphere masses, which are of the order of 100 picograms for this thing. And you can do this actually with both positive and negative charges. That is, in other words, to increasing or decreasing the optical field as you do this. You can do in various vacuum states, which are the different symbols in this thing. And it, you get actually very consistent measurements. In fact, for each microsphere, so the points down here are the average of different techniques applied to the same microsphere. So here I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on microspheres. And so, so you can see that for every microsphere, I get actually consistent results. And then those microspheres are all pretty similar to each other in terms of their masses. You see they go from, 82 to 85 picograms. The last three microspheres are special because students are very good and they figure out a way after the microsphere is suspended in there to actually get it off the trap onto a piece of silicon and then go in a electron microscope and essentially measure the microsphere. So those last three microspheres are number one, number two, and number three here on the silicon plate. And now you can measure very well their size and diameter and so on. And you can actually measure, you can extract the density, which is somewhat lower than the silica density. So the density of this material, you just buy this stuff, right? So I can tell you the name of how they make it, but it's essentially something that you buy. And it's 1.5 gram per cubic centimeter, where fused silica is more like 2.2. But that's kind of useful because eventually you want to know what kind of mass those things have. So the other trick you can play is that you can actually manipulate the rotation of the microsphere because the microsphere has some unpleasant property, which in this case you use, and that is has an electric dipole moment. And so I told you it's neutral, and I know really well that it's very neutral, but that doesn't mean the charges are entirely homogeneous around. There's a little bit of charge imbalance either on the surface or on the bulk or both. It's probably on the surface for the most part, but that's... And so what I can do now, I can actually use my electrodes around this thing, those gold-plated things, to produce a rotating electric field. And so now the dipole is coupled to this thing and it follows the electric field and I can speed it up and down as I wish. You can also use linearly polarized light, which is something that Dave and others and Marcus and so on have been using their labs to spin them up. But we actually use this rotating electric field, so that's what I'm talking about. We still use the birefringence of the microspheres to read the orientation of the microsphere itself. So this is kind of nice because you use the electric field coupling to the electric dipole moment to actuate the rotation, and then you use the birefringence to actually read out the rotation of this thing. So it's kind of, there's no crosstalk between those two things, between the actuation and the readout. And you can measure the angle between the direction the electric field is pointing to and the electric dipole moment of the microsphere. Okay, so that's what I'm showing here. You also see that there is, this is actually the frequency at which the electric field is rotating and the microsphere is rotating. But if you look at the Fourier transform of the polarization of the direction of polarization of the microsphere, you see that there are some sidebands, and one of them is blown up here. And what is that? Well, that's essentially the libration motion. That is, if I'm in the reference frame of the electric field that is rotating, the microsphere does this kind of thing, like you put a bar magnet in a bigger magnetic field, just whips around that way. Okay, so we'll use this in a minute, or we'll talk about this in a minute. For the time being, just be aware that it's there. But I can use this, for instance, as vacuum sensing, because now what I can do, I can spin up the microsphere, then I watch it spin, and now I turn off the rotating field, and this thing slowly spins down with an exponential behavior that is shown here. And actually, from first principles, these are actually Lisa people calculated from the gas dynamics what you expect the relationship to be between pressure and pressure, gas species, and spin down time constant, and so you can use this to measure the vacuum. Okay, so this is actually. Let me just move on because this is actually okay. So remember, I told you about libration. That is the fact that this thing is whipping around. You can also cool that degree of freedom by essentially retarding or advancing the rotating electric field to essentially stabilize the smoothest possible rotation of your microsphere. And so this is done here. Actually, what's shown here is the envelope of this kind of libration motion that is here, right? This is this the amplitude of this oscillation, and so as function of time. So what you do is that you at some point you kick so you essentially excite that vibration or that libration by making a sudden step in the electric field, and so now. The damping that we impose from the outside essentially dumps that vibration or that libration motion, and depending on the gain of my feedback loop, you can see that I'm cooling this thing faster, or I'm essentially damping down the motion faster or slower. One thing that makes this analysis very complicated. And that is actually really important for the gravity measurements later on, is that actually that electric dipole moment, the strength and the direction of the electric dipole moment, but the strength in particular, are not stable in time, which was something that we, for a long time, we suspected, but only recently we've become more quantitative about. And so you can see here, so that what's happening here is that this is this frequency of this sort of libration. Which of course depends on the strength of the electric dipole moment or magnitude of the electric dipole moment, and you can see just for the time being just look at concentrate on the gray histogram here, which is for 200 second integration, and then you wait 5 hours and you see that this peak is this thing is resonating at different frequency by a couple of hertz or something, and that's simply because the electric dipole moment has changed over time. In fact. Over my 200 seconds, those are two particular, three particular, the blue, purple, and yellow curves are subsets of the data set. And so even at the level of 200 seconds, this thing changes. So we don't know yet what to do about this. There's all sorts of ideas on how to suppress this. Maybe you metal coat those things slightly. Maybe you actually have microspheres which are slightly conductive. And all that. So this is sort of active investigation. But you can see you can use it, or it's depending on the circumstances. It's actually hurting you or maybe helping you.
Giorgio.
Okay.
Giorgio, may I ask you, how spherical are these objects?
Say it again.
How spherical are these objects?
Well, they're pretty spherical. There you go. Right. The asphericity is less than 1%. You can see it here. This is a fit to a sphere, the red thing, and you can see the image of this. And they're very spherical. There are some defective ones. Occasionally, there are some which are half sphere or something. They look like a broken eggshell. But those actually, they behave so weird in the trap that you immediately know that there's something wrong. You throw them away, and they are cheap, by the way. That's
and the density is totally uniform.
The density the density is assumed to be uniform. We have no reason to think that it's not uniform, but we don't know for sure. that to just, you know, this is, we cannot measure that, okay? Everybody assumes they're uniform density. I think that's a good assumption, but. Okay, so let's see, what else? There is other tricks you can do, which I'll now skip. Let me just move on. Of course, those are gyroscopes. Once you spin them up, you can then apply an electric field rotating in the at 90 degree difference, and then you see precess. And you can calculate how it's supposed to precess, and everything works very well. So all the rotation dynamics of those things is actually really quite well understood. So now let me move on to the measurement we particularly care about. And so now, Mina, you see that I have a shield. I have my rastering attractor. I have a shield, and then I have the microsphere here. The shield doesn't shake. What moves is this thing, and this shield is just sitting there. That's crucial. Otherwise, you know.
Yeah, but I'm saying that because the thing moves, doesn't cause vibrations to the shield. It looks
well. Sure. I mean, you know.
It's
yes.
Tiny.
You have to be very careful, and yes, there is probably some background from vibration, which we'll get to. Patience. to do experimental physics, you need some patience, so you cannot. So the measurement is done over 10 to the 5 seconds. Those are somewhat larger spheres that I mentioned, that I dealt with until now. So they're more like half nanogram. And this thing goes back and forth by 200 microns. The pitch of this thing is 40 microns, so the distance between a green key and the center of a green key and the center of a yellow key is 40 microns. The separation, you can see it here. Now, remember, now you can do the measurement, you can really measure the vector force or the force vector. So at least in principle, you can actually decide what separation to have in X, Y, and Z, which we'll play with, you know, we'll discuss more about this in a minute. X and Z, Y, is the thing that scans back and forth. So that is sort of, you can change the stroke, but I'll get more into this in a minute. All right, but that's actually the setup. Just to give an idea that this is real thing, this is actually real, this piano keyboard. It's like a cantilever made out of silicon, which has been etched and has been filled with gold. Let's see, the thickness of the beam of this cantilever is only 10 microns, so those are very delicate affairs. What I'm showing here is in the device just one step before the end, because the final step is to gold coat everything to try to have as little as possible electromagnetic contrast, if you want. But then, of course, you don't see anything anymore, so that's why the picture is given here. Then next thing is that this is the shield is also kind of built in a piece of silicon. And so again, you can see it here. It's got this sort of like fence sort of shape. The laser beam, the trapping laser beam goes up this way in between those kind of things. Some of our attractors are actually asymmetric, like the cartoon here. Some are like the one I'm showing here with symmetric, but this doesn't make any difference. And they are all, again, they are made out of silicon, but then they are gold-coated. And that's just an idea how this works. In reality, it moves somewhat faster than this. The measurement is done at 13 hertz. This is slowed down, so you can actually see it. Okay, so the first thing, you know, I told you that this is very versatile, so what you can do is you want to really calibrate your force behavior or your force sensing property of this, and you can see that this is really done in three dimensions. I can apply an electric field along the three axes and measure the response along the three axes. So you have the diagonal term. This is the the signal in some sense calibration, and then the off-diagonal terms are how much of X you get when you excite Y, or how much Z you get when you excite X or Y, and so on. So you actually can characterize this all quite well, and typically it's like an order, it's like 10%. The crosstalk is about 10%. In part, it's due to the fact that the optical axis and the electromagnetic axis are not exactly aligned and there's some sort of, you know, the entire thing is not really perfectly sort of configured, if you want. So in this first measurement, which is now almost like a year old or 9 months old, you can see, okay, so you can see what happens, you know, the this is now the frequency, you know, this is an FFT of the signal. There is a red and a black curves. Black is when you don't move the attractor, so this is the intrinsic noise of the system. And this is calibrated in Newton per square root of Hertz. And so you can see that in around 10 Hertz, which is where it works best, this is down, you know, off order, I don't know, 20 attonewton or something of that sort, per square root of Hertz. But then, of course, you integrate over some number of seconds or minutes. And then red is when you run the when you raster scan the attractor behind the shield. And so you see that actually the noise generally doesn't increase much, but since some lines appear. There are some lines that are also there in the static case, like this guy here. But then some other, you know, a larger number of lines sort of appear. And so those are, and so, okay, so you say, well, you know, maybe you've detected something. Well, okay, so the pattern that you expect to see from a gravitational-like interaction are actually shown by the blue little bars. And so those are all the harmonics. You know, there is the fundamental frequency at which you're shaking this thing or moving this thing, and then the various harmonics of it. And you see that they don't match, right? So you would expect, for instance, a big line here, and you don't see it. There's nothing here. There is something here, but it's, you know, this one is on top of it, but this one is not. And so there is actually, you know, it seems like this is not the right the right thing. But, you know, you move on and do your analysis. This first measurement, the system worked substantially better on the z-axis than in x and y, and so the measurement is done only with the along the z direction. By the way, if this was all working well, that is, had the same sensitivity on the three axes, the phase of the signal is different in z, sorry, in y and in x and z, because. Well, okay, if you think, so first of all, if the attractor is the same level as the microsphere, then the force in Z is zero and should just be zero, and you shouldn't really, now if, as you offset it up and down, you should be able to see the force become, you know, go up and down, you know, change direction. And then if you look at, you know, between the attractor and the microsphere in that direction, which we call X here, you actually get the maximum force when, say, the gold finger is in front of the microsphere. But if you look in the along y, now you're 90 degrees out of phase. The maximum force is when you are aligned so that the contrast is where the maximum contrast or the separation between gold and silicon is where the microsphere is. So there's actually lots of features that we're not using because two of the degrees of freedom were not working as well as z. But so as far, you know, so this is actually about a day or 24 hours of data. And so what you do is that, you know, from the previous sort of FFT here, and from what you expect in the blue, you know, from those blue little plateaus, you decide which harmonics are, you know, give you most of the contrast between signal and background. And so those are the six harmonics that are shown here. And so then you look how, you know, and you keep measuring it for, in this case, say about a day, and then you actually do some sort of likelihood fit where you try to extract that interaction and see whether it matches, you know, the kind of pattern of harmonics that you expect. Notice that among other things, this is actually changing on the time scale of a day. The entire thing is going up, you know. So there is some sort of something. You know, you don't expect gravity or anomalous gravity to change over a day this way, right? So this points to the fact that there is some background, or there are some backgrounds in the measurement. So Okay, so this is an analysis of systematics, but it doesn't really matter because most of what we have is a background. So it turns out that the background at this point is pretty clear that it's mostly due to those dipole interactions. And so what we're doing here is that we're just saying, okay, so there is a, if there is a dipole, and the dipole is, okay, I forgot the number, but it's of the order of, okay, so this is 1,000 electron micron, which is typical for those microspheres. Maybe the number more typical is like few 200-300, and we're using 1,000 here, but that's essentially the right order of magnitude. And now what I'm assuming is that I have a 50 millivolt contact potential between the shield and the attractor. So now if I go back, maybe I should have put another slide here. If I go back here, right? So you see this object here and this object here are electrically connected together, but that doesn't mean they have exactly the same potential because of contact potentials. And in fact, contact potentials also depend on temperature, and which you know may well change over a day some. And so then what happens is that you get essentially some electric field going from this, the edge of this guy to the edge of this guy, and some of it leaks around to where the sphere is. And of course, this has got gradients because it's some crazy electric field that comes from this kind of situation. And so that couples or may couple to the electric dipole moment of the microsphere. And so what I'm saying here is that if I assume 50 millivolt contact potential and 1,000 electron micron dipole moment, then along x and z, I get this pattern of harmonics. And if I now take, including my fit, this kind of signal, I get something which is very consistent with what I see. Okay, so that just means that the signal I see, call it signal, is entirely explained, can be entirely explained by this sort of an effect. So now I can actually take this sort of, the level of the background and call it the limit. Gravity is not greater than that, and I get something which is still not as good as some of the other measurements we've done. But I think this issue of finding, of understanding, I think this is actually quite a bit of a step forward in terms of understanding or trying to understand those backgrounds. And in fact, actually, since that measurement was done, we've made quite a bit of progress in understanding this thing even further and suppressing it, which is the next few slides, and then I'm done. So now I'd like to actually zoom in a little bit on this rotation business. And again, one should really show this in 3D, so it's a little bit sort of tricky this way. But so this picture here, so essentially the microsphere is surrounded by six little platelets, which are each biasable, can be biased its own way. And so now if I'm looking from the top, those are the four plates that I see. And those are the plates that I can actually use to spin the microsphere up. So I'm spinning the microsphere this way by essentially applying two sine waves 90 degrees out of phase to the two pairs of platelets here. Now, at the same time, so now the microsphere is spinning this way. And if it was not spinning, and I would be exciting the vertical platelets up and down this way with an electric field, then if there is a gradient in here, I would actually see the coupling of that gradient to the electric dipole moment of the microsphere, and the microsphere will move up and down sort of this way. But in reality, what I'm doing, which I was not doing in the measurement before, but I'm doing now, is to actually also spin the microsphere in one of the planes, in the horizontal plane. And so now what you're doing, essentially, you are averaging the charge around the microsphere, at least in the plane where you are rotating it. And I can also rotate in the vertical plane, and then I'm essentially suppressing the dipole moment in that direction. So this kind of rotation gives you factors between 10 and 100 suppression of the electric dipole moment effect. But there is actually more than this. What you can do is to actually write down an equation for the force, the electrostatic force or the electric force, that has the monopole term. This is zero. This is essentially the term that looks like gravity. And and this electrostatic term is zero because there's no charge in there. Or maybe there is a there is a charge there, and that's a millicharge or a mini charge, or is an asymmetry between the electron charge and the proton charge in that microsphere. Then there is a dipole term, which where the dipole of the of my microsphere couples to the gradient of electric field. And then there is an induced dipole term, which is, as far as we know, quite a bit smaller. And so we'll be worrying, the dominant term is this guy here. The dominant background term is this guy here. Now, one thing that one can, that we've noticed is that actually, so suppose I just treat the microsphere that is just sitting there, and the microsphere can have a charge or a monopole term, and a dipole, like is shown here. And now instead of, and now I deliberately apply some gradient of electric field, meaning I bias this electrode here, say positive, and then I ground everything else. So now you actually get field lines that are like here. I can also reverse the same thing and now ground all these guys and then apply plus here. Now when I do that, you see the direction of, or you know, the force direction for the monopole changes, but the dipole keeps being pushed up in both cases, okay, by the gradients that are both here and here. So that's a way of distinguishing between the dipole interaction and the monopole interaction. And I think this is actually something that is really quite new, and so you can use this to actually measure and suppress those backgrounds. So that's actually shown here, and this is, works remarkably well. I'm really impressed by how well this works. So remember what I've done here. I've actually called the two situations, this case here is called F plus, is, the force, say, in the case of this bias, and the other one is F minus, the case where I'm biasing it backwards. Now, if those electrode configuration was exactly identical in the two cases, you would actually subtract F plus and F minus, and you'd be left only with the, you would be essentially selecting just the dipole and suppressing the monopole. And then if you would add them up, it would be the other way around. In reality, the trap is not perfectly symmetric, and so there is this omega term, which is essentially the asymmetry. This can be measured, but can also be calculated by using FEA, essentially mapping the dimensions as measured of the trap and putting it into a finite element analysis code. So what I'm showing here now on the top graph in blue and red, I'm showing F plus and F minus in attonewtons. And you see that it's pretty crazy. I mean, as function of time, again, this is like a day and a half or 2 days of work, of data. And this thing sort of jumps up and down quite a bit. Both the F plus and F minus. But if I now take the difference between the two, then this thing is, you really suppress the background a great deal. And in fact, this is all you have left is really the noise, which we believe is at this point pointing noise from the laser. Okay, so that's actually a very powerful way of subtracting the data. In fact, even better, if instead of just subtracting the two of them, I plot one against the other, so this is now F plus and F minus, you see that this thing beautifully decouples. Along the blue axis, I have the permanent dipole moment, and along the purple axis here, I have the monopole interaction. And so you see that this data has a very large dispersion in dipole interactions, is also not centered. The cloud along the blue axis is centered maybe here. So you measure a finite effect because the microsphere has a dipole moment. But along the monopole axis, it's narrower, the distribution is narrower, and is also really right on centered here. Okay, so this is actually a breakthrough, I think, in doing this kind of measurements. And now, furthermore, this is done at F0, at the frequency you're exciting the thing. At 2F, you get the induced dipole moment. And there is actually more physics there that we haven't explored yet. And it's all written down, but for various reasons, we haven't really gotten around doing this. Okay, so you can actually use this thing to revisit an old measurement we did when Dave was actually in my group that is actually searching for mini charge or millicharge particles. And at that time, for that thing, we were again at the background. That is, we could see that there was a background. We could see that this background was likely not a millicharge because it didn't behave like it was oriented the right way and so on, but we didn't know what it was, and so it would actually set a limit there. But now with this thing, you can actually separate out the monopole charge from the dipoles, and so you actually start going down, for a time being just a little bit, but down to levels of 3 × 10⁻⁵. This can be easily improved by integrating more and so on and so, but we were in a hurry to actually refurbish the trap, so we haven't really done that. And so actually, maybe let me just go to the next slide, which is maybe more, I don't know if it's more interesting. But anyway, this is actually about this millicharge. So the millicharge measurements done before, first at Stanford, and then Dave repeated this thing at Yale, moving further down by using larger, you know, this is in terms of abundance per nucleon. So this is done using larger microspheres. But you can see that in terms of charge sensitivity, you're stuck with this dipole moment thing. Whereas now with this new technique, you can actually, the limit that is published is this guy here. But we think we can actually go down to this blue line. Red is some other measurement. Now I'm blanking out about more about this. But anyway, it's a different technique that hopefully we'll be able to surpass. So okay. So now assuming that I'm done, right? It's time to yeah. Assuming that this is actually this dipole moment business is taken care of at least to a large extent. There is actually still backgrounds coming from stray light. Remember, this is actually what I said, you know, you are essentially intercepting part of the laser field that comes in, so that's sort of a problem. Mina, you should become an experimentalist. There's vibrations. We are pretty sure we have some background coming from vibration. And then there is later on, there is laser pointing noise and probably quite far in the future, Casimir forces. So I said that we have taken apart the trap and we are actually just restarting now things. We have improved the situation with stray light. We know now how to deal with the electric dipole moment. We have made the thing much more rigid, so hopefully vibration is less of an issue. And then next thing, I remember I said, fixing or improving pointing noise, which has to do with essentially doing a better job with the optics that is in outside of the vacuum chamber. And then coming up, there is also, instead of measuring, sorry, this is kind of a little bit technical, instead of measuring the position of in X and Y with just a quadrant photodiode, which is what we're doing now, we have a multi-pixel device so that you can understand better if there are sort of problems with the light field that you are intercepting there. Maybe more important in terms of vibrations, instead of rastering back and forth, which is, clearly is something that produces vibration. We have a rotary attractor, which is just being made as we speak. In fact, it's essentially done now. And you can see now the little holes are the anti-gravity or are the give the contrast. This is gold, actually. So there is gold, and then there is nothing where you... And this is done... Okay, so... And the machinery to spin this thing is done by our friends. Of course, if you do something like this, it looks like a Swiss watch, so you get a group from Lausanne helping you. So that's where the machinery comes from. And then those disks are actually made by a company in Germany because they're essentially electroformed with gold, not with silicon, and it seems more convenient. So hopefully we'll put this thing together soon. So these are the conclusions. Since we're late, as usual, there's no point in really spending too much time on this, but hopefully this technique, which is very new, right? So it's taken a number of years to, we are not even as good as the best people around because, that's a new technique, but there's great potential. And I think I'm very hopeful that with this idea of, with this being able to deal with the electric effects in a quantitative way, will improve drastically how those things are done. And lest I forget, this is the team has done all the work because I only do the talking and they do the work. Thank you.
Thank you, Giorgio. Any questions from students? Yeah, you will throw it.
Yeah, hi, Giorgio. So I guess I've always had this question. in terms of measuring gravity, obviously for larger spheres, we get larger force. And there's also a fundamental limit on how well we can measure this, the response of the sphere correspond to the external field, and how well we can measure this response from the scattered light. And I guess my question is, of course, we're both doing microsphere spark, but are microspheres really the right things to go with? Or have we actually carefully think about everything and decided we need to do microspheres?
No, I mean, I don't think it's, well, you know, other colleagues may actually have different opinions, I don't know. I mean, I don't think, you know, I can say straight face that microspheres I know are the best thing. So maybe micro flying saucers are better. I mean, there's some, but you know, on the other hand, those geometrical factors, so if you're talking about some levitated object, I don't think it matters. So, you know, the aspect ratios and geometry usually, you know, does a factor of two or something, you know. So that's, you know, it's, I don't think you can actually find the magic shape that is so much better. Now, larger spheres are as you know, actually are better. And I think our measurements, the measurement I showed is done with 7.5 micron diameter spheres. And as we start again, we'll go to larger spheres. Now, you guys know that, or told us that you can't levitate stuff, at least with the wavelength, with that wavelength and that silica, more than 15 micron-ish, because now you start essentially vaporizing. You know, there's so much dissipation inside that you vaporize the surface, and so they automatically become 15 microns.
Yeah, that's
So you can't go very large, but I mean, we'll probably go as large as, you know, maybe I think we try 12 microns, so they seem to work fine. So we'll probably do the measurement with microspheres between 10, 12 micron, and 12 micron diameter. But you know, I don't know that this is, look, this is in some sense, I've been claiming that we want to do it this way as opposed to, say, a torsion balance. And that's already a choice. There might be other ways that are even better
I guess what I have in mind is, for example, nanospheres. Marcus probably have more opinions.
Well, but
this.
I mean, okay, so that I think it's, I cannot show you the math, but I mean, we've done those, we've tried different sizes and so on, and actually going large is usually good. Now, the one thing I don't know, okay, so the one thing I don't know for sure is that those electromagnetic properties, whether charges redistribute, and there is this kind of an annoying fact that the electric dipole moment changes with time, it's possible that the Stober process silica is not the best material and something else is better. This is unfortunately a common problem in experimental physics. That is, we bought a large collection of different materials, and then it's always the thing that you'll do next, you know, trying something else, because you're always in a hurry to do the measurement. So we would like to try other microspheres. I even have micro diamonds, believe it or not. But we never have time to actually try those things. So eventually we'll get around trying other materials. Maybe they're better.
Okay,
but,
thank you.
I mean, actually, but there was one material that, okay, so we did buy some microspheres that are coated with a slightly conductive polymer. And this may actually be really good. And I think those are the first one. You know, I think soon we'll try those because that seems kind of quite, potentially quite nice.
Okay, hi. Thanks for the nice talk. I'm kind of a more practical person, but I've heard that some string theorists are excited about the idea of additional micron scale extra dimensions. Micron scale extra dimensions. Okay. And I was wondering if your setup is sensitive to those kinds of theories.
Microsphere. Okay, I mean, that's actually for you guys to answer. I don't know how. I mean, look, yes, Mina, it's your, or Savas, where is Savas?
Savas is out of the room. He's the one that proposed it to begin with. So yes, I mean, it's very well motivated. The current constraint in, there are several reasons why going for 1 times gravity at sub 50 micron scales is very good. First of all, I think Peter mentioned the other day, it's the scale of the cosmological constant, but also the prediction is, given what we know from the LHC, if you had a theory of large extra dimensions to explain the hierarchy problem, this is the size of the extra dimensions you would expect. So, one times gravity at a smaller scale as possible is actually a great target to test Newton's law, no matter what.
All right. Thanks for the very nice talk. I have a couple of questions. Maybe they're not fair, I don't know. One is, you talked about how you have a very good vacuum gauge with this spinning spheres. How much error or correction, or do you have to correct for the fact that your sphere may absorb, you know, residual gases or water, or, you know, are you in ultra-high vacuum? Go ahead.
You had two questions. Do you want to ask them both and then answer, or maybe sure. I start so, answering
okay.
this?
Okay, and then the second question is related to using gold everywhere. And in the quantum information community, people who do trapped ion quantum computing know that gold has some anomalous heating effects that is not well understood and causes errors in their trapped ions in a way that they don't like. And I don't know if this is an example of that as well, some eddy currents occurring that then affect your microsphere.
Yep. Yeah, good, thanks. Yes, those are both excellent questions. Now, the first one is, they're both technical questions, which I like. The issue about vacuum, so those things are remarkably good vacuum gauges. And in fact, I don't know, while I talk, I can try to scroll back. The graph I showed, okay, sorry, let me just go. Yeah, where was it? Here, yeah. So this is a one parameter fit. You cannot even see it, but there's data and a fit through this thing. And the fit is single, is one parameter, is the time constant. There's nothing else. And the model is this paper here by these people. So there's just works out of the box. And as a range that, if you do it carefully, has a very broad range. And by that I mean there's actually I glossed over some of those things. So this is done by the spin down, if you want, technique. So you let it go and then you watch it spin down. But the other thing you can do, which I think was somewhere. Oh, sorry, it's here, I guess. Yes. The other thing you can do is to actually look at the libration frequency and essentially measure the libration frequency and measure and infer the vacuum from the libration frequency and so where is the slide? I thought I had a slide. So what you do is that you actually look at the angle, the average angle around the libration between the microsphere, read out from the polarization, and the direction of the electric field. And as the pressure increases, this angle becomes larger because at fixed peak voltage of your electric field. And so that's what you can see here, right? So if I have low field, or let me start here, the figure is clearer. So at 66 kilovolt per meter, you see that as the pressure increases, this angle becomes larger and larger because it takes more and more torque to actually pull it through until the point where it unlocks. When you get here, you see the rotation phase becomes random simply because the electric field can't drag it anymore. Okay. So if you put together this technique with the spin down technique, you can go to, we measured down to, I believe, like 10 to the minus 7 or 10 to the minus 8, all the way to Torr pressure. So as a very, those are very broad range, absolutely calibrated vacuum gauges. The other thing you can do is that you can measure the vacuum in a different with a different technique, say with a baratron, like it's done here, and then use the the measurement of the microsphere rotation to decide which species, what is the mass of the molecules in the gas. Because, you know, in the previous, in that paper, there you go, this paper here, of course, you have to assume something for the molecular mass of the species you're there, or the average molecular mass. So what you see here is now, you know, is the is essentially a parameter that decides the mass of the gas. And this is, so we have repeated the measurement with helium, nitrogen, all the way to xenon and sulfur and sulfuride to find something very heavy. And so you can, this is like an RGA that doesn't ionize the gas, okay? Of course, it's not quite true. This is a little bit of a cheat, because an RGA gives you the entire spectrum of masses. This measures just the average, some weighted average of the masses. But if you have a single gas, you can actually measure what a single gas is without ionizing the gas. So it's actually quite nice as a vacuum gauge. Whether it's worth, you know, $100,000 optics table and, you know, with all this gadgetry and so on, that's a different story. On the other hand, it makes a local measurement. You know, each microsphere has a few microns, and if you have an array of microspheres, you can actually map the vacuum very locally there. So I don't know, you know, maybe.
But does it cause, is the amount of correction potentially to the mass, that your test mass, negligible because the amount of?
Yeah, that is a very, that correction is very small. It's much better than an ionization gauge, for sure. Okay, we should probably, that, you know, maybe most people don't care. What was the other question? I already forgot.
Anomalous heating and gold.
Ah, yes. So one, yeah, so that has to do with, so instead of coating with gold, for instance, we like to actually coat the surfaces with graphite. And we're learning how to do aquadag with the idea that maybe if you have very, you know, this very non-crystalline, you know, the crystals are very small and so on, maybe those kind of situations are better. However, with the shield, the background we see is not patch potentials. It is the contact potential between the shield and the attractor. So at first order, it doesn't matter whether it's gold, but certainly could very well be that gold was not the right thing.
There is a quick question from online.
Wow.
In the slide before the conclusions, you were mentioning FPGAs. What will they improve?
FPGA, sorry, where is this?
In a slide before the conclusions.
Slide before the conclusions.
What do you want to use the FPGA for?
Oh, I see. You mean, must be here, yeah, right. I don't even know where it is. I wrote FPGA.
I mean, the person can also mute him or herself and ask directly.
I don't see FPGA. FPGA, never mind. I mean, look, this is really technical. So the idea is that you can actually, look at those 100 pixels and process the, do some sort of crude image processing, you know, at high speed, and then apply your feedbacks and everything at high speed. But, you know, this is kind of a really technical detail.
Giorgio, yeah. So you showed these calibration curves where you were applying the force, and you showed versus frequency, and I was just curious what, with the gravitation measurement, what frequency you use for driving the attractor. Like, is it, do you want to be, like, there was some resonant response there. Do you want to be on resonance for this?
Or okay.
You, what's the choice
so
of that frequency?
So it doesn't look like being on resonance is any particular advantage. So we are generally running quite a bit below the resonant frequency. And in fact, I think I sold you something slightly, I bamboozled you. I told you that you're running 13 hertz. It's actually running at 3 hertz. And then you look at all the harmonics, so the 3 hertz. The 13 hertz was some previous test run and so on, but the science run is done at 3 hertz. So the frequency at which you run, that's an interesting point. In the next run, we'll be a little bit more careful about this. 3 hertz is not bad because you look at some of the harmonics which end up in that, you know, 5 to 20 hertz sweet spot where you have the most, you know, the best noise situation. But it's not really optimized. I say, you know, but we didn't really optimize it. One of the real issues is that if you run much faster than 3 hertz, the entire thing shakes like crazy. And it doesn't, you know. So this is actually one of the things that, so once I'm in the lab and we're running at, I don't know, 10 hertz, and I look at this thing and say, whoa, this thing is crazy. Really, we're running this fast? This looks like it's shaking everything. Which, of course, is not shaking everything, but still, It feels bad to do that. I mean, you know, it feels like there's too much inertia in the system to run it that fast. Now, of course, if you run with the rotary attractor, then it's an entirely different story, and then we can probably run it at various frequencies. I think the rastering thing is gonna stay around, you know, between 3 and 5 hertz as fundamental frequency.
Okay.
You kick me out now.
Because we have gone way over time.
Sorry.
But no, thank you for the great talk. No, it's great to have the question. So let's thank Giorgio again.